Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. First up, in a few minutes, we'll speak with Dan Labatz, who is a journalist and educator, who close student of the U.S. auto industry. And we'll ask him what his read of why the U.S. auto industry is in such dire straits, whether the union, the UAW, can survive this rough patch, and how we might get out of it, if we can at all. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Raihan Salam, who is an editor at The Atlantic magazine and widely identified as one of the leading lights, if such things exist now, or the future of the American conservative movement. The American conservative movement looking rather routed after the last election. Do they have a future? Raihan Salam will address that question. He's been on the show before, but I thought worth checking back in with him after the rout that the Republicans experienced a couple of weeks ago. First of all, some observations on the economic news. Bad news coming from both the financial sphere and the real economy. Treasury Secretary Henry Hank Paulson's decision, announced last week, to abandon the purchase of bad bank assets entirely has sent the credit markets into a tizzy. You may recall that when Paulson first unleashed his proposal in September, the one that would have given him sole discretion to spend $700 billion without even the possibility of congressional or judicial review, that's all he wanted to do, buy bad assets. A number of critics, including me, pointed out that historical reviews of past financial crises found such asset purchase programs to work not so well. Much better was to inject fresh capital into troubled banks. Congress heard these critiques, though I doubt they heard mine, and wrote the bailout legislation so broadly that it would permit such equity injections, and a lot besides, it seems. Paulson apparently saw the light himself and did nothing but equity injections once the legislation passed in early October, though of a particularly indulgent kind, equity injections that gave the government no voice at all in running the institutions it was attempting to rescue or even getting a good accounting of where all that cash was going. And then, last week, he said no asset purchases at all, which was quite mystifying. Despite the poor historical record of asset purchases, this time it might have been different, because one of the things that's crippling the credit markets is that no one really knows how much their partly toxic, partly sound mortgage assets are worth. There's no market in them at all right now. Had the government bought some of them, it might have put a floor under prices and given some guidance about how much they were actually worth. Emphasis on mighta, coulda. Now Paulson won't be doing that. But his surprise decision, his second 180 in as many months, made it seem like the whole mega-billion bailout operation was being done on the fly. It does not inspire confidence from any perspective, and the credit markets, which had been giving some signs of thawing in recent weeks, went back into the deep freeze. No credit markets, no economy. It's looking like Paulson's giving his Wall Street friends a lot of money with no strings attached and no strategy either. Let's hope the new gang can run a proper bailout and with more consideration for people in or near foreclosure than Brother Hank has been showing. Speaking of the new gang, how about that Attorney General choice, Eric Holder, a man who defended Chiquita Banana against charges that it was subsidizing death squads in Colombia and ended up getting his client off with just a slap on the wrist. And now, back to the real economy. The latest batch of news has been pretty terrible. On Wednesday, the Census Bureau reported that housing starts and permits to build new houses both hit all-time lows. And that's not in percentage terms or relative to the size of the economy. It's in absolute numbers. Numbers that go back almost 50 years to when the U.S. population was about 40% lower than it is now. In other words, the housing market hasn't been this weak since the 1930s. But still, prices would have to fall another 15% just to reach their long-term average ratio to household incomes. Another fall of that magnitude, prices are already down about 20%, would put even more homeowners underwater, owing more in their mortgage than the house is worth, and prompt more defaults and foreclosure. It's a big damn mess. And the job market looks to be weakening as well. On Thursday morning, the Labor Department announced that first-time claims for unemployment insurance rose by 27,000 last week to 542,000. While not the highest number on record, either in numerical terms or especially as a percentage of the labor force, it's still been rising sharply, up 22% just over the last couple of months. This almost certainly means that November's employment report, to be released on the first Friday morning of December, will look horrible. For the first half of this year, job losses looked mainly to be a function of a hiring strike by employers. Layoffs and firings were relatively modest by the standards of earlier recessions. That's all changed now, and job losses are rising sharply. Earlier in the week, we learned that prices at both the producer and consumer level fell in October. These declines were driven mainly by falls in energy and other commodity prices, but they did raise the specter of deflation, a generalized fall in prices that is only seen in very tough times, like the U.S. in the 1930s, or, in a milder version, Japan in the 1990s. My guess is that we're more likely to see something like Japan in the 1990s here, a long period of high unemployment and economic stagnation, but no generalized collapse. The government is spending too much money for a true collapse to take hold, but things are already nasty and are getting nastier. If there's a silver lining in all this, it's that the culture, at least, might get a little more interesting. John Maynard Keynes once wrote that by far the greater proportion of the world's greatest writers and artists have flourished in the atmosphere of buoyancy, exhilaration, and the freedom from economic cares felt by the governing class, which is engendered by profit inflations. That's the end of the quote from Keynes. Evidently, the cultural elasticity of profit isn't what it used to be. Shakespeare died rich, said Keynes, the beneficiary of one of the great bull markets of all time, the greatest the world had seen before the American 1920s. The American 1980s and 1990s were a massive bull move, but all we got was reality TV. But as the stock market pundit Robert Prechter likes to point out, bear markets and recessions bring out what he calls nihilistic music, like two of my favorite pop genres, punk and rap. He contrasts this with the upbeat music characteristic of bull markets. As he pointed out, attendance at the Love Parade Festival, a kind of outdoor techno rave party held every summer in Berlin, rose from its beginnings in 1989 throughout the 1990s, peaking in 1999 and 2000 with over a million attendees, peaking also along with the economic cycle. But with the recession of 2001, attendance fell, and the festival wasn't even held for a few years afterwards. Prechter's theory is that all the good feelings celebrated by the Love Parade were byproducts of a buoyant economic mood. When things turned dark in the economy, love moved indoors, if it moved anywhere at all. Now, this may be all a bit too mechanical, an odd bit of economic determinism applied to popular culture. But there was a great cultural ferment in New York from the mid-1970s through the early 1980s. As Wall Street became dominant in the city, following the takeoff of the Great Bull Market in August 1982, the environment became a lot more difficult for the creative underclass, with rents up the hedge funders taking over everything in sight. And while the streets might get dirtier, the subways more crowded, and jobs hard to come by as tough times take hold, maybe there will be some fresh and compelling art and music produced as a compensation. In the spirit of all that, the music on today's show dates from between 1974 and 1982. First up, a taste of television's first record, a single issued in 1975 on Ork Records. This is from the original vinyl, Pops and All.
Johnny Jew, he's so cool. He had no decision. He's just trying to television. Well, some thought this was sad, and others thought it mad. They just scratching the surface. JJ could do the floor kiss. Was he on display? No, not today. All that guy ever said, he said, I want my little wing head. He'd be half asleep at night, over his head, sensation of flight. And he'd wake up dreaming. Down to the airport.
and that a bit of television's debut record, Little Johnny Jewel from 1975. And we're now joined on the line by Dan Labatz, who is a writer, activist, educator based in Cincinnati and a longtime student and analyst of the auto sector in particular. Welcome to Behind the News, Dan Labatz.
Thanks for inviting me, Doug. Good to be here.
So let's start with just some long historical sweep. How did the auto industry get into such trouble? I mean, they've had 30 years to adapt to foreign competition. They don't seem to have done a very good job of it.
Well, I think that's right. I think that they, you know, they had a model that they developed in the 1950s and 60s. They were, in those days, the big kind of autogalopoly. They had, you know, the big three could really dominate and control the market, and they developed a big, heavy, expensive, sometimes beautiful, sometimes homely American car that millions of people wanted. And when safety issues developed, they ignored them. When fuel efficiency issues developed, they ignored them. When pressure from environmentalists developed, they ignored that. That is the auto companies and the managers of those companies ignored the public. And they found themselves, beginning in the late 60s, facing this these new things, these bugs from Germany, the Volkswagen Beetle that began to drive around the streets, and Japanese cars came into the market, and they really weren't prepared to deal with that kind of competition. They had had a kind of monopoly, and they were not prepared to deal with the foreign competition. They did not adapt, and the foreign competition at first imported cars using, you know, in Japan, in Korea, and other countries. People were operating with green fields. They went to brand new spaces. They built brand new state-of-the-art technology. They employed cheaper labor with fewer benefits, less expensive labor, and they were able to also compete economically with these American cars. And so I think that those two things, the failure of the auto industry to the auto corporations to make a decision about the kinds of cars they made and their inability to compete economically with cheaper labor, both of which put them in a position to not be able to compete.
But what you're describing happened 40 years ago or more. Shouldn't they have woken up in the past four decades?
Well, I think that's true. They should have. And I think perhaps we should say more importantly that you know, as a person who works with labor unions and is concerned about the union movement, I think also the labor union movement should have awakened to the fact that there had to be a change made in the auto industry. And if the auto industry leadership couldn't make it, I think they had to take more initiative and make proposals to change that industry and to develop the political power to change the industry. The auto unions failed. They continued to rely on the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party didn't give them the changes they wanted in labor organization to be able to organize the transplants, that is, the foreign plants that were being built in the United States to produce automobiles. They relied on the Democrats. They created no new organizing drive among workers. They didn't create a new form of political power. So I think that we also have to say that American labor movement had some serious weaknesses here to figure out how to deal with this issue.
Yeah, well, you actually anticipated my next question. So the UAW, once a very dynamic, politically left-wing union, or that was its reputation, very important to the organization of American labor in the early 1930s. What happened to that heritage?
Well, I think that you had a long period, you know, where for, let's say, from the World War II, when really during World War II, the government brought together the auto industry and the unions and said, let's the three of us be partners to win World War II. And I think Nelson Lichtenstein, historian of the auto industry, argued in his first book that that really changed the union, this partnership that began during World War II with the corporations, with the government. And then you had this long period where the American economy was the most dynamic and powerful economy on the planet. The rest of the planet had been bombed out of existence during World War II, right? So it took a while for those other countries to revive. And so you had a period of economic prosperity and security for most workers that goes up until from the beginning of World War II until the beginning of the 1970s. And in that period, the people who had built the union largely died, disappeared, retired, and the leadership changed. And you had a group of leaders who had not been leading a union in a struggle to make that union a power. They were people who had spent 30 years in ritualized negotiations, which became very often the trade-off for wage increases of working conditions in the plant. The introduction of automation and the loss of control of the union of the shop floor, the loss of workers of protection and security on the shop floor, that constantly increasing speed of the line, that movement of the line that so exhausts people and so wears them out and wears them down. And the union didn't respond to that. And I remember, I think it was Leonard Woodcock who suddenly said in the early 70s, well, what's going on here? Management has launched a class struggle against us. And that was true, that the employers began in the 1970s to look to ways to try to reduce the power of the union. And the union found itself unable to adapt, unable to respond, unwilling to listen to new voices that arose within the UAW. The UAW, Walter Reuther, a socialist, a organizer and builder of that union, and a very strong political personality and a great organizer, had organized within the UAW a caucus which ran that union from the day he took over leadership of it until and still runs it today. And that caucus meant that there was very little change percolating up from below, very little competition for ideas and outlooks within the union. And really, the union did not take on the needs of its members and more important probably in a certain sense, in a broader sense, didn't take on the needs of all the working people in society or didn't think about where did the union fit into America.
Yeah, you make that point. You have a piece in on the Monthly Review website, mrzine.org, and posted a couple of days ago. And you make the point that the UAW has really not done anything to make friends with the broader American working class. So how much sympathy is there now for the plight of auto workers among the broader American population?
Well, I think that's probably hard to judge. There's probably a section of the American population that understands that the UAW was the flagship once of the CIO. It was the leader of a big industrial union movement that brought higher wages and better working conditions and brought a series of benefits in health and pensions. And I think there's probably many people out there, older people in particular, but others who have union jobs or some who just have read a little or thought about this, who do appreciate and understand how important unions have been, and that it's important to try to defend those better organized, stronger sections of the working class that have something. But there's also a lot of people, I think, who have looked upon, and I think the right wing created this, the right wing in our country, conservative political commentators and so on, tried to make out that it was the privileged union organized elites who were driving the companies into the ground, who were pricing themselves out of the market, who were killing the goose that laid the golden egg, all of these conservative phrases that said that it was workers and unions who were destroying these industries. I don't think that's true, but I think it also, they preyed upon this notion that these were the more privileged workers. They had things other workers didn't have, which was true. But of course, that was because they had fought for them and won them and had defended them, while other workers might have fought, maybe won some of them, didn't get all of them. But the UAW did fail to reach out after a certain point, sometime in the 1970s, the UAW didn't really reach out to build a broader union movement that it would need today to be able to defend itself in this situation. It doesn't have the allies it might have had.
I'm speaking with Dan Labatz, who is a writer, educator, activist based in Cincinnati. Well, let's talk about the compensation of auto workers. I think a lot of people think they're making $70 an hour, and maybe you're a Walmart worker making, if you're lucky to make $12, you might think these are kind of pampered workers. What is the actual situation of labor in the auto business now?
Well, I think the actual situation today is that you still have some workers who have a total compensation package, which for the highest paid workers can reach around a little above $50, $50. But that's a total compensation package. So that means that they're getting wages of about $26 an hour, and they have other payments being made toward their retirement fund and toward their health plan. But what's happened is that the employers succeeded in the period of the 19, really beginning with the Chrysler bailout, the employer succeeded in breaking up what we call the pattern agreement or the big contract that covered all big three workers. And since then, they continue to break up the bargaining units of the UAW. They continue to take on, if they can, one company or even one plant at a time. And they've been able to negotiate contracts, what we call two-tier contracts. A two-tier contract meaning that the older worker who worked there might be getting paid $26 an hour. But those older workers were faced with a contract, faced with the possibility of a long-term strike, maybe seeing their union crushed by management in a strike, as happened really recently at American Axle Company. And so the workers decide, we'll accept a two-tier system. The new workers will come in at $14 an hour. So, and this is what recently happened at American Axle, where workers' wages are really cut in half. They're now coming in at half the wages they earned before, many workers making $14 an hour. Now, the goal of management will say, we have to do this to bring them down to the level of Toyota, let's say. But, of course, if they get down to that level, Toyota, without a union, without a contract, can go to its workers and just tell them, tomorrow you're working for $13 an hour. Take it or leave it. So this becomes a devastating, you know, the phrase has been used often. Maybe it's become a cliche. I don't know. It's certainly it's a very, really a poignant expression. It becomes the race to the bottom. And this is what can happen here in the auto industry.
Well, what is the likelihood that GM, Ford, Chrysler are all running low on cash? They're talking about having only a couple of months of money left to keep going. They could enter bankruptcy, wipe out a bunch of their debts, and break those contracts. It could be the effective end of the UAW. Isn't this a real possibility?
I think it is. I think it's a really very dangerous possibility. And, of course, I was struck by Mitt Romney's essay in the New York Times a couple days ago when he says, let them go bankrupt. And let these companies go bankrupt. And exactly, that's, of course, exactly what they want. That is people in management, people, economic, political conservatives, want to see this bankruptcy take place so the bankruptcy can be used as a whip to break these contracts, to lower wages, to get rid of the union altogether, perhaps, as you're suggesting. I think that is a very real danger, that bankruptcy could be used to wipe out the union, and it has to. The union should be defended against that. People should join to defend the UAW from having that happen, because unions play such an important role in society, and those better organized sectors of workers, they do represent a certain benchmark. They do establish a certain pattern. They represent a goal to aim for other workers. They represent certain liberated areas sometimes in terms of the workplace where they've been able to establish decent conditions that might not exist in other workplaces. Unions have played such a key role in democratizing our society. They've been such a factor in many social movements in the past. And so to see unions destroyed, and destroyed really in the heartland of the industrial labor movement in the UAW, would be a terrible thing.
People often wonder, one of the problems that the U.S. auto companies face is high health costs, high health insurance costs. People often wonder why management doesn't lobby for a single-payer system, have the government pick up health costs or a large portion of it. Do you have an understanding of why management is not jumping on that bandwagon?
I don't. And I wonder if you do.
My only guess is, long-term class interest. They don't want the working class to get anything or want anything, and want to keep them prostrate. But other than that, I can't really think of anything. It would seem rational.
I mean, it seems, there was the argument could be made. I mean, I guess I tend to see that same answer. I mean, the argument could be made some time ago to say, well, look, if they could get health care out of the bargaining costs of the company, that would be good for both the company to compete with foreign companies and be good for the union, because now they could defend their wages more easily if the total package didn't have to include those health care costs.
No, but doesn't the union look at health benefits as a selling point, and they might be not so enthusiastic about having it generalized to the whole population?
That's an interesting question. I think, if you went back into the historic past in the union, that people like Reuther and other founders of the union who were socialists, who were concerned about the working class as a whole, they would have seen the importance of negotiating something like a real social security system, such as other countries have, which means you have a real pension and a real living wage, and that real health benefits as part of that, a national health care system. And I think it's true that once the union had that, that did become a selling point. I don't like to think that the union leadership would be so cynical that they would think that would be such an important selling point to their union. They would not want to see other American workers covered in a national single payer, or even better yet, a real national health care system.
Well, let's hope they're not that cynical. All right. So let's turn to the what is to be done question, which is always reserved for the last three or four minutes of an interview. But you have some suggestions in your MR piece about nationalizing the sector. Could you lay that out for us?
Well, I think first, the whole question of nationalization of industries, this whole question has been raised really by what happened with the banks recently, and having this financial crisis, and having the U.S. government intervene and in various ways to nationalize a number of banks. And so when you can see that the U.S. government can come up with $700 billion to save bankers, and with no strings attached and no conditions, it does seem to me it should not sit well with the American people to say you can give $700 billion to bankers and you can do nothing to save working-class communities that are going to be millions of people who'd be affected by the bankruptcy of the auto industry. So therefore, if nationalization can be on the agenda for the banks, why can it not also be on the agenda for the auto industry? And I think that the word nationalization brings to mind, in most people's minds, a failing Soviet economy or something like that. And I think what we really need is a kind of governmental but also a popular intervention, that we're not interested in simply nationalizing, having the government take over and run the company the way that the big three have run it, or the way the Soviet Union ran its companies or something. We really need a government and a popular intervention. The government could take over and buy these companies, but we need to get all of those engineers and technicians, those highly skilled workers, those experienced and loyal employees of those companies to become people who would really play a big role in running these corporations. I mean, this is a tremendous... Imagine what happens if we let this go bankrupt and we let tens of thousands of this cadre of people with all this knowledge, with all this experience, with years of relating to each other and working together, and we let that just be destroyed. That's perhaps the biggest shame of it all. And what if we were able to keep those people together and say, you have this talent, you have this experience. Let's work together with the environmentalists, with the consumers, and together, engineers, technicians, skilled workers, consumers, environmentalists, let's carry out the transformation of this national industry to make it something that could solve our transportation problems in this country, that could solve the infrastructure problems of the country, that could begin to reverse some of the environmental damage that our entire planet has suffered. Let's create a national auto transportation and energy industry that the government would own, that workers together with consumers and other important social movements like the environmentalists would help to direct, and let's produce things the country really needs and keep these communities from disintegrating and keep this incredible cadre of technicians and engineers and skilled workers together, and let's really build something meaningful for this country.
Well, you make a compelling case. If only the union and the broad popular consciousness were up to speed with you.
Well, I think it's a big problem we have. Two problems we have in this country is that at the moment, the working class movement and popular movements in this country, social movements are very weak, and we need to do everything we can to build them in every area, from the environmental movement, the anti-war movement, the GLBTQ movement, and so on. Every single movement, social movement, is important to us. Each one helps to keep the other alive and develop it. And the labor movement, of course, has to be central to this. And at the same time, we have to rebuild the movements, but we also have to create a more imaginative and creative popular consciousness around the question of how to create an economy that we can all play a role in developing an economy that will make this a better country, a better planet. And I think that has to do with thinking about notions of democratic socialism, of the role of working class people in not simply nationalizing and having the government run something, but having the people be involved in creating a better economy and a better society.
I couldn't agree with you more. I've been speaking with Dan Labatz, who is an author, educator, activist based in Cincinnati, and you can find his piece on the What is to be Done about the Auto Industry on the Monthly Review website. You can get it at mrzine.org, mrzine.org. All right, let's take a break.
WBAI, 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 New York, New York, New York, New York, WBAI, 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 New York, New York, New York, New York.
We're the New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
And this is WBAI, not only on your FM dial at 99.5 in New York, but on the web at WBAI.org. And please do visit the website and take the opportunity to press the donate button in the corner. And if you like what you hear here, help keep it going. We do need your support in these troubled times. All right, let's take a musical break, another relic from the last slump. And we'll be back to talk with Ron Salam.
My brother's doing fast on my mother's TV. Says she watches too much, it's just not healthy. All my children in the daytime, Dallas at night. Can't even see the game or the Sugar Ray fight. The bill collectors, they ring my phone and scare my wife when I'm not home. Got a bum education, double-digit inflation. Can't take the train to the job, there's a strike at the station. Me on King Kong, standing on my back, can't stop to turn around. Broke my sacroiliac, a mid-range migraine, cancer membrane. Sometimes I think I'm going insane, I swear I might hijack a plane. Don't push me. Call, close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
And that's some of The Message by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, 1982, released a couple of months before the bull market took off in August of that year and changed everything. And we're now joined by Ryan Salon, who is an editor at The Atlantic magazine and co-author of the book Grand New Party, and widely considered one of the more promising faces on the American conservative movement these days. Welcome to Behind the News, Ryan.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Actually, welcome back. You've been here before. So the election of a couple of weeks ago looked like a bit of a rout for the American right wing. Do you what's your analysis of that Tuesday?
Yeah, I mean, I think that actually the scale of the popular vote victory understates the real shift, the real underlying political shift. For example, you know, George H.W. Bush won a bigger victory, but I think that actually you really are seeing the beginning of some kind of durable progressive majority, or at least that's what it looks like to me.
What makes you say that?
Well, a lot of things. I think that actually you saw a lot of structural forces moving that direction in the late 1990s. And then George W. Bush managed to win as a kind of centrist Republican who was running against, you know, Gingrich-style conservatism. Then in 2004, you had national security politics coming to the fore in a way that hadn't been the case for a long time. So you had these two highly unusual elections, the first one in which the Republican candidate actually lost the popular vote, as you know, and the second in which you just had some, you know, pretty unusual circumstances intervening. And otherwise, you've had a big, big, durable demographic shift toward constituencies that are more inclined to vote for Democrats. For example, single adult households, and also a lot of new Americans, new voters. So I think that the Republican Party had this opportunity to really reframe their message, to actually cut against these big, broad structural and demographic shifts, and they failed to do so.
So it's looking like the Republican Party is now more and more isolated towards older voters, highly religious voters, and people in the South, and those are all not exactly growing parts of the population. So,
well, if you know, half of the Republicans in Congress now, more than half, come from the states of the old Confederacy. So, you know, that gives you some indication of where they are.
Is there a future in that strategy?
Well, I think that, you know, I'm actually pretty optimistic about Republican prospects, assuming that the conservative movement is able to retool itself for the kind of new political and economic environment. But I think that that's going to be a wrenching process. So, you know, is there much percentage in the current strategy of talking exclusively about tax cuts and national security? No, I don't think there is. But I think that there are ways to apply some of the logic of the kind of conservative movement that we saw post-stagflation to the new challenges. The problem is that's going to take a lot of intellectual spade work, and it's going to require jettisoning some powerful interests, and it's going to require, you know, a really vigorous debate. And, you know, I think that's going to take a long time.
Well, sometimes it seems to me that the conservative movement, the Republican Party, is in a situation similar to that of the Democrats and the liberals in the late 1970s. You know, it was kind of the decadence of Keynesianism. The welfare state was looking tired. We had economic crisis of the late 1970s, stagflation. The right wing looked to some, even to a majority of the American population, as if it had some solutions to those problems. Here we are, you know, 30 years later, and the problems are severe, but almost in reverse. You know, now deflation is the problem. We have an economic recession, living standards for a lot of Americans have been declining for the better part of 30 years. The right wing looks as tired as the liberal movement did in those days, and they're just repeating the same old formulas. Is that a fair comparison?
I have a slightly different interpretation, though. I think broadly speaking, I think there's something to what you're saying. I'd say that, you know, it wasn't so much that the public embraced right-of-center ideas. I think the public, you know, just was making a retrospective judgment that, wow, the Carter years seem to have been grim economically, so we'll give this other guy a try. And then the conservative movement tried to interpret that as a mandate for conservative ideas. But what they really just had was a mandate to do something different. And I think you're seeing something similar now. I mean, it's not obvious to me that the public has embraced, you know, progressive ideology as you and I understand it necessarily, but they're open to it, which is very, very significant. And so I think that, you know, there are some parallels in that regard, but there's also some reasons to be cautious, just as, you know, when the Gingrich conservatives came in after 94, they really believed wrongly that they had a mandate for shrinking the size of the state, but they didn't. You know, they had a mandate for tweaking things, for reforming some institutions. So I think that, you know, there's a danger in overinterpreting your mandate, and I think that conservatives certainly have done that to some extent, particularly, you know, after Bush's reelection in 2004.
Well, another thing that interferes with my neat parallelism or mirror images or whatever you want to call it, is that in the late 70s, early 80s, there was a counter-establishment, as Sidney Blumenthal called it, waiting in the wings. There was an agenda and an organization. Does anything like that exist in the liberal left now?
I think it sort of does. For example, you've had lots of folks on the liberal left who were really excluded for not just, you know, 8 years, but for 28 years, you might say. You know, during the Clinton era, you had, you know, Clinton come in 92 with an agenda that was public investment driven, that actually had kind of a populist social democratic cast to it, and then that was abandoned shortly after he came into office. So I think that there are many, many people who are inclined to use the regulatory levers of the state, to use industrial policy, to build what many on the progressive left call a high road economy. Now, I, you know, predictably enough, sort of don't necessarily agree with that strategy, but I think that there are a lot of people who have been waiting in the wings for that, and I think that you're going to see them. Well, you see, so far with, you know, Obama's cabinet appointments and other announcements, you've seen what looks like a Clintonite restoration. But I'm curious as to what's going to happen, you know, below that top level. And if you're going to have some of those, you know, progressives who are frustrated during the Clinton years and very eager to see their ideas, you know, take over. The labor movement has declined to some extent, but they've also been very good at leveraging, you know, enthusiasm and intellect to, you know, I think really have a seat at the table in an Obama White House. So we'll see what happens.
Well, also the circumstances are rather different from what they were in 93 when Clinton was first taking power.
Oh, yeah.
Large-scale Keynesian spending programs are much more acceptable now than they were, 10, 15 years
ago. And many people on the right are actually going to be inclined to embrace large-scale, you know, spending on public investment as well. So I think you're right about that. And I think that, you know, there is deep confusion among conservatives. And I think that, you know, it's interesting because you see progressives like, you know, or you see even Clintonite centrists like, you know, a guy like Bernard Schwartz, and, you know, people like Rubin who, you know, used to be very deficit-oriented now have become very enthusiastic about increasing public spending on infrastructure. So I think that actually you see a lot more coherence on the left, and some of, you know, the old factional infighting, I think, has gone by the wayside in response to what looks like a really historic downturn.
I'll speak with Ron Salam, who is an editor at The Atlantic Magazine and co-author of the book Grand New Party. Party and the future of conservatism to some people. Well, speaking of conservatism and infighting, it's been remarkable to watch, for example, what's been going on within National Review magazine. You know, certainly a crucial journal to the rising fortunes of American conservatism from the 50s into recent history. And now you've got all these defections and infighting and resignations and accusations of treason and all kinds of terrible things. What's going on in the conservative movement?
Well, I think that, you know, you had David Frum leave National Review, and he's someone that I think of as a very kind of impressive, thoughtful guy. But also, you know, Rich Lowry, the current editor of National Review, is also, I think, a very, you know, thoughtful, intelligent guy. And I think that they had, you know, some honest, straightforward disagreements about what would be the best way to kind of approach thinking about the movement. And I think that, you know, David felt that he had an opportunity to run a new, exciting, you know, media property. So I don't think of it as anything, you know, too deep-seated. I think that you're going to have stylistic differences, and there are some ideological cleavages. You know, for example, there are a lot of social moderates, social liberals on the Republican side who are very frustrated by what they see as the Palinization, the populism, the cultural populism and the anti-elitism, which they find suffocating and deeply problematic, particularly as the college-educated slice of the U.S. population increases. To Republican political prospects. So, I mean, these are real disagreements that are going to get hashed out. But I tend to think that, you know, that to me is a lot less important than the question of whether or not Republican domestic policy is going to move beyond tax cutting.
Well, the Republican coalition, or the Reagan coalition, one of the magic things that Reagan was able to do is to keep together this coalition of religious conservatives and free marketeers, whose religion is money. Has that coalition now broken apart?
Well, that's tough to say. I mean, you have a lot of complicated cross-cutting things. For example, when you're looking at evangelicals, lots of folks in the press focus on younger evangelicals, you know, who think about the environment, who think about other a different mix of issues from their, you know, forebears. But the thing is also a lot of younger evangelicals are more ideologically conservative or more ideologically libertarian. So, I mean, it's a complicated landscape out there. You have Mike Huckabee, who seemed to prefigure a kind of Christian democratic, you know, populist evangelical politics. But then you also have other figures, you know, who are just very much, you know, kind of both fiscal and social conservatives. So, you know, I think that I'm not so sure you're going to see a divorce. For example, you know, if you look at the people who are the most ideological on social issues in the Republican coalition, they're actually the kind of upscale voters because they can afford to vote on, you know, issues like, you know, culture war issues. Whereas, you know, kind of less affluent Republicans, they tend to vote Republican because they're aspirational voters. So, you know, and certainly the cultural issues matter to them, but they matter a lot less than for, you know, kind of these rich suburban Republicans who, you know, consider their social conservatism to be, you know, a very key part of their identity.
Well, let's dwell on that a minute because, you know, Tom Frank got famous for arguing that.
Arguing
the opposite. You don't agree with that analysis.
Well, I think that Tom Frank is a brilliant guy, but I think that, you know, when you look at the data, it just looks like, you know, both social liberals and social conservatives, people who, you know, vote on those issues tend to be a little richer, whereas people who are, you know, less affluent. So, you know, so then you might wonder, well, why the heck is someone who's lower middle class voting Republican? But, you know, if you're making what is a lower middle class income in New York, in Little Rock, you become tax sensitive pretty quickly because you don't actually sense that you're benefiting as much from government programs, whether or not, you know, you think you are, you know, whether or not we think that same person is. So if you're living in Fairfax County and, you know, a dense suburban county right outside of Washington, D.C., even if you're upper middle class, you see government every day. You see government as what's, you know, kind of, you know, keeping, you know, the traffic flowing, and it delivers a lot of vital public services. So even if you're more affluent and, you know, you would think more tax sensitive, you might think that government's a pretty good deal. Whereas if you're living in some of these areas that have become the Republican heartland in, you know, small towns and smaller cities, you're less inclined to think that way. So I think that sometimes we look a little too crudely at income rather than looking at where are you situated in the economy and where are you situated regionally.
So how could the conservative movement reinvent itself to appeal to the new American demographic?
Well, my view is that you've got to look at the total package of what people are spending money on. Taxes for the median family were a very big deal in 1980, but they're far less of a big deal now because the income tax, at least, has grown more progressive, though let's not forget the Social Security payroll tax, which is takes a big bite out of poorer Americans. But I think that given that's the case, you know, an exclusive focus on income taxes is simply stupid. And, you know, then you're looking at health insurance premiums. Those costs have skyrocketed. And Republicans haven't had very good answers to that problem. Or if you're looking at, you know, housing in good school districts, stuff like that, you know, that broad landscape, Republicans need to tackle those costs as they tackled taxes in the early 1980s. That is, how can we deliver a decent middle-class life to more people at lower cost? How can we facilitate upward mobility? And if they were able to talk about that in an intelligent and persuasive way, they'd be in good shape. And they'd have a very powerful argument against some ideological liberals who really want more density. They want more government regulation, and they want certain goods to actually be more expensive for environmental or other reasons that are defensible but, you know, are contestable.
Well, let's reviewing the recent election. The Joe the Plumber thing was a total flop. McCain was hammering after that and trying to present Obama as a share of the wealther, and it just didn't work. Does that mean that it was not credible that Obama was some sort of socialist share of the wealther, or there's actually some appeal to that message in the American population?
I think it wasn't seen as credible because this was the first election cycle in a long time where the Democrats offered steeper tax reductions for middle-class voters than the Republicans did. And the whole socialism charge, based on this idea that refundable tax credits are socialism, just seemed a little specious. But, you know, given how the tax code has changed over the last, you know, since about 90, you know, you're actually not, you know, the Democrats are in a very, very good position because they can just keep saying, we're going to hike taxes on the top 1, 2%, and we're going to cut your taxes, even if you're not paying any taxes, we'll cut it into a negative rate. And the Republicans are going to keep wanting to emphasize that top rate, you know, because that's a constituency that they're beholden to. And until you change that dynamic, the Democrats are going to have a real advantage on the tax issue.
Well, let's get back to some of your the areas that the Republicans have to address. For example, what could a creative conservative approach to health care be?
Well, you know, we're obviously only on this radio program for a little while, so, you know, there's only – but I mean,
yes, the three-minute version.
I'd say that some approach that involves federal reinsurance and that involves, you know, trying to shift people toward catastrophic coverage, but mainly one that involves – really exposing the corruption of medical providers. You have lots of business interests that profit off of waste, fraud, and abuse, big, powerful business interests that fund both political parties. And, you know, it's amazing the lack of transparency. And it's amazing the way that nurse practitioners and other medical professionals are severely disadvantaged by the current system relative to physicians. And I think that, you know, just a broad restructuring of this industry to increase transparency, to increase competition, but also to see to it that, you know, no one is going to go bankrupt because of medical expenses. That's what people really, really fear. So I think that a kind of income protection approach is something that would actually be compatible with a kind of more market-oriented and cheaper and more effective approach to healthcare.
Now, who are these corrupt providers you're talking about? Pharmaceutical industry or?
Well, the pharmaceutical industry, I mean, sort of is, you know, kind of a part of it. But I'd actually, you know, mainly say it's you know, just very, very pervasive. And if you're looking at, like, big hospital groups that don't offer integrated health care, they don't offer any real data concerning what the actual prices are for providing different services. You know, and also, you know, you have fraudulent billing that's, you know, kind of a really kind of big pervasive deal. I think that, you know, it's just structured in such a way where the providers want to shift costs wherever they can, whether it's to the feds or to private individuals, rather than actually deliver higher quality and better care at lower prices. So, you know, it's really dysfunctional in that regard. So I think that it's, you know, is there someone that I can point to as being a kind of, you know, corrupt Daddy Warbucks figure? Not really. The whole system is corrupt.
Now, what about the school issue? I think people find that their own schools are okay, but they still think there's a great education crisis afoot. What would your approach be to that?
Doug, that's really, really astute. I think that you have a situation where, you know, I think we do have an educational crisis, but the crisis is that we're spending four times as much and we're getting the same outcomes as we did 40 years ago. That's one part of it. The other part of it is that if you're looking at white middle-class kids in this country, they are doing better than Koreans in science and math. They're doing better than the Finns, you know, in reading, literacy, et cetera. It's people who come from my background, people who are, you know, non-white in this country, who are really struggling. And part of that is family structure, because if you're a poor kid, you're poor 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You're only in school 8 hours a day, you know, 5 days a week, and only 10 months out of the year. So to expect miracles from the schools is simply unfair. But at the margin, I think there are good things that we can do to tilt things in a better direction. And that's going to involve, you know, giving parents more control of the schools, I think.
Well, you've touched on something which is, of course, also a problem with the Republicans in a country with the white population shrinking as a percentage. The Republican Party, the conservative movement more broadly, is seen as a very white upper class thing, and it wants to reinvent itself, perhaps to have more diverse appeal. But there's a certain bedrock of the party that really doesn't like non-white people. How can they deal with that?
I disagree a little bit with that. But I mean, here's one thing. One thing is, I totally agree that the Republican Party is a very, very white party. But when you're looking at voters making over $200,000 a year, Obama won that group by a little bit. And if you're looking at voters making over $10 million a year, the Democrats have done very, very well. But, you know, bracketing that question, it's certainly true that in states like Mississippi, the rich are voting Republican, and the Republican Party is certainly a very white party. Now, I don't think that it's actually so much a matter of distaste for non-whites. I think that, you know, in any society that's gone through the kind of rapid demographic change that we've gone through, there's going to be some unease, and there's going to be some mutual misunderstanding that's rooted in the fact that, you know, the Republican parts of the country are the whitest parts of the country. The Democratic parts of the country are the areas that have been diverse for a pretty long time. And so, you know, it's interesting because that also shapes your taste for government services, too. When you're living in a very diverse area, you're, you know, as Robert Putnam found, you're less likely to know your neighbors. When I was growing up in Brooklyn, you know, we barely knew the people who lived on our street. We had ethnic networks. We had friends through, you know, my parents' work and through, you know, my school friends and what have you. But, I mean, it's very different from small-town America. So, you know, that introduces lots of psychic tensions and lots of distrust and unease. And what's amazing to me is that America has gone through demographic changes that, you know, few other countries have. But when other countries have gone through these changes, they've seen real violence. Even if you look at a place like Holland, which is a kind of civilized social democracy. So I think that, you know, that's muted, and it happens, you know, sometimes through these big identitarian symbolic struggles we call presidential elections. But I think that, you know, as the country grows more ethnically diverse, the Republicans are going to have to, you know, appeal to those voters. But I think the way to do it is not qua ethnicity, but rather by offering a better deal for the middle class.
Are there any people, any politicians that you can see as the possible electoral bearers of a new kind of republicanism, a new kind of conservatism?
I absolutely do. I mean, I've become very enthusiastic about a guy that I imagine your listeners are not too fond of, but Mitch Daniels, the governor of Indiana, who is a, you know, guy, I'm a very short person and so is he, so I like that about him. And I feel like he matches up against Obama's extraordinary height. And also, he is someone who came into office and, you know, took some steps that were deeply unpopular, but then was reelected with the strength of a lot of people who also voted for Barack Obama, a lot of UAW members. He called for a tax hike on Indianans making, Hoosiers, I should say, making over $100,000 a year to close the budget gap, not because he loves raising taxes, because he felt that it was fair. And I think that he's a Republican who just seems very sane. He seems like a problem solver, and he just seems very unpretentious and appealing for that reason. So I think that he'd actually line up very, very well against Barack Obama. Not that he'd win necessarily, but I think he could really close the gap and also present a new face for the party.
Well, of course, a lot depends upon how Obama does in office.
Absolutely. And I also just want to say that we should all wish him well. And, you know, sort of, I know a lot of my friends on the left are very critical of the Democrats from the left, and I'm obviously critical of the Democrats from the right. But, you know, we all want to see him succeed. And this economic downturn is going to impact and already has impacted a lot of people in a very kind of sharp, harsh way. So, you know, I certainly am not, you know, rooting for him to fail, though, you know, my kind of partisan affiliation, you know, leads me to want Republicans to do better.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for concluding on a constructive note.
Actually, thank you, Doug.
Much of what you said was quite constructive. I don't want to mischaracterize with the preceding 20 minutes. Thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Ryan Salam, who is an editor of The Atlantic Magazine and co-author of the book Grand New Party, a book that came out a while ago, but has a roadmap for how the Republicans might reinvent and save themselves. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I will be back next week. And let's go out with yet another bit of memories from the period, the last period of economic troubles. This is Hey Joe. It's performed by Patti Smith with Tom Verlaine noodling on a guitar in the background. This is from 1974. Till next week. Bye.